Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Heretic Hammer Podcast. I'm your host, Marshall, and this is my co-host, Dylan.
Hello, hello.
And today, we're coming out with some secret information. Nobody needs, you know, nobody can know this. Nobody can. Hey, what are we doing?
Marshall? Hello? Marshall, are you there?
And that is the dramatization of being taken by the Inquisition. Oops.
Oh.
Yes.
I believed it.
Let me ask you a firm question here, Dylan. When you look at this image, who are the good guys?
Hang on, let me zoom in. let me zoom in and see if I can find them. Let me track them down. It's like a Where's Waldo painting, you know? You gotta really look at every detail to see
who are the good guys? See.
Who the I got it. I found him.
Yeah.
It's the giant horned skull above the doorway there on the left side. That's a good guy. That's a good guy right there.
This is one of my favorite images of an inquisitor, because
of any
the retinue behind him is just like looks no different than the chaos cultists that they're shooting at. Mm-hmm. Like, my favorite is the two people, or like two of the people on the right of the Inquisitor. So like there's the guy who's actually behind, to the right, but behind, or I guess to the left of the Inquisitor's perspective. But our perspective, to the right of the Inquisitor, but behind him, and he clearly just like clobbered the hell out of the person in front of him. Right. But then in front of that guy, so the farthest right, is a dude in a gas mask holding a with both of his hands over his head, bringing a chainsword down. And you can only know that he is chaos because of the symbol on his like chest plate.
Yeah.
But like the difference between that guy to the right and the person just to the left of the picture behind the Inquisitor are so like, what is the difference?
yeah for sure.
I thought that person to the left was a chaos cultist until I realized, no wait, they're behind him. Which they're arriving with the Inquisitor. And you know, that's just 40k for you.
This is why gang colors are important.
Right. And thus, this is, you know, to denote to you, the holy orders of the Emperor's Inquisition are those with the utmost power in the Imperium. They are the secret police of the 42nd millennium, and are the word of the Emperor made manifest.
Mm.
Now, you know, you may think sometimes, you know, right, like, you know, doesn't absolute power corrupt?
Absolutely.
Correct. But only if you get caught doing so. And thus is often the way that Inquisitors tend to work.
Every time.
Yeah. So today we'll be talking about the three main ordos. Because obviously the Inquisition is an incredibly deep content and concept and everything. There are technically a bunch of minor ordos. But you'll generally ever hear, you know, an Inquisitor being from the three main ordos, of which the power, you know, or like we'll talk, and obviously we'll talk more about their power and even some of the limits that Inquisitors do get. And usually those are limited by other Inquisitors, but we'll talk about that, as well as all the fun toys that you get to play with if you are into the Agents of the Imperium. So, you know, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
So, there are two kind of theories around the finding of the Inquisition, right? And part of the argument for them is it's one of those things, honestly, where like I kind of feel like it's a bit of both. Right. Which is kind of going to be the same thing with a couple of origin stories with factions in 40K. When we get to Death Watch, it'll kind of be like a similar thing where there's like two theories, but they don't necessarily conflict. So they kind of could both be true. And that is to start off with, the Emperor ordered Malkador, you know, kind of while he was on the Golden Throne, but like not like interred, but like kind of when the heresy was kind of getting down, the Siege of Terror was getting through, Magnus fucked up shit. So the Emperor is trying to, you know, combat a psychic war on the Golden Throne. You know, so he ordered Malkador to attain those of character, skill, and determination. And Malkador returned with 12 people, which amongst them were a good number of Space Marines. And those became the first Grey Knights. And that was about 8 of the 12 people. And then 4 of them were standard humans that would conceivably become the first of the supposed Inquisitors, right? Like those, the supposed first 4 who founded the Inquisition. But they were essentially just like 4 humans of great loyalty, character, skill, and determination, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And thus, that was kind of the baseline that like those 4 became the first Inquisitors. So the technical second one, but again, kind of, I think, just is kind of almost a second half of the first part. So again, kind of why they're not really conflicting, is that after the Emperor was interred on the Golden Throne, 4 of his trusted servants came together to discuss what to do next. And the thought was then that they would kind of split in half, where 2 went off to find a way to resurrect the Emperor, and 2 that felt that they couldn't change what happened. There was no going back. What happened, happened. What will be done to sustain the Emperor is what will be done. But they will otherwise just move forward and continue to keep the Imperium going to the will, what the will of the Emperor was, right? So they're operating off of like the 2 that stayed are like operating off of the realm of like we will read and we will look at and we will kind of dictate, this is everything the Emperor wanted of us. Right. Mm-hmm. This is what he wanted his Imperium to be. But we don't have the Emperor anymore. So now we must find new ways to instill this into the Imperium itself and keep order and battle and conquest through the stars. And part of that aspect will relate later to another discussion we'll have about rogue traitors, but are outside of the Inquisition. That's why we won't talk about them today. But in terms of fighting threats and dealing with things, this is where the Inquisitors come in. So, as I mentioned, with the 4, there were the 4 Inquisitors, quote unquote, and those who left were called the Resurrectionists, and they eventually led into a bunch of issues that then essentially, after they went through a bunch of Civil War stuff, and we honestly can have a whole topic about them, like a podcast episode and whatnot about themselves, is called the Herusians. Which, if you were to spell it H-O-R-U-S-I-A-N-S, you'll notice there's the Horus in there.
Yeah.
That obviously comes into a whole thing where essentially they tried to go out, seek. The long and short of that part, though, is obviously the Resurrectionists went to seek answers about trying to find a way to resurrect the Emperor, flew too close to the sun, the Chaos Sun, and fell into some shit. So how the Herusians came about and like that whole debacle, that's a whole other topic. But then the remaining 2 founded the traditional Inquisition as we know it, primarily in M42, on Titan. The same Titan that we find the Grey Knights, which will come into a somewhat of a play here in a minute. But they would find and split into the first two ordos, which would be the Ordo Xenos and Ordo Malleus. And like I said, there's not really a whole lot of conflict between the first two, like the first concept and the second one. It was just kind of like, really the only thing was the first one kind of makes it seem like there were always four Inquisitors to start, where technically the second one then just kind of gives an explanation. Then after, you know, Horus dies, the heresy ends, and the Emperor is put on the throne to be a rotting carcass, you know, there are essentially, we've just got a bunch of, like, they're figuring it out. And essentially the two that remain decided, hey, we're going to create these two ordos. And we'll talk about those ordos in more detail in a moment. But let's talk first, how do you become an Inquisitor? So becoming an Inquisitor is not a choice. Rather a calling.
Oh.
That is brought to you by the discovery from an Inquisitor. Or whatever, one way or another, an Inquisitor finds you, sees you, and they take interest in you. They think you have potential. There's something to gauge with you. You know, we'll have actually a fun story with one Inquisitor of Ordo Malleus in a bit. But, you know, an Inquisitor kind of finds you, and they're just kind of like, all right, you, I see you. You've got something about you. Oftentimes, they'll maybe find somebody who maybe is a sanctioned psyker, or, you know, maybe is in the Schola Progenia, which isn't necessarily a common way that people are found. So I didn't feel like the Schola was something to talk about here, because when we get to a different, like, kind of around the Rogue Trader and some of the, like, noble stuff, that's kind of when the Schola will somewhat be more relevant to talk about, because it's essentially like the Imperial school system. It's not like one specific place, but sometimes maybe they'll find someone out there, you know, or someone in the school, kind of anywhere though, right? Like, they could be raiding somewhere and all of a sudden they're just like, you. Or maybe like there's a commander, right? They're going with a commander. They're on a mission, and like a commander from the guard, or a, you know, like a, you know, or even a normal guardsman or whatever, like literally anybody. But it's obviously that they have achieved something of note that has really sparked the interest, and it's not an easy thing to do. But then they're just kind of like, all right, you're coming with me. And there's no saying no.
You're okay, Inquisitor. Get in.
It's just, you're going in the car with him.
Mm-hmm. Hop in the crazy taxi. Let's go.
Yeah. And so when you are found, you'll start by being an acolyte of some kind. Now, this sometimes is an interrogator, an explicator, neophyte, novitiate, or approbator. I think I'm saying that right. Now, interrogators are some of the ones that you'll commonly see in lore, whatnot, the game, Rogue Trader. You know, this one of your companions is an interrogator to an Inquisitor.
Mm-hmm.
And they are commonly seen also a wave. They're the ones, if you see them without their Inquisitor, they're the ones you will likely also see. They're the ones that maybe will get some of the most trust from an Inquisitor, and are often a psyker, though, again, it is a common trait amongst a lot of Inquisitors is to have some type of, you know, even if it's really small, but have some type of psychic ability, though it is by far not like a requirement. It's just one of those things that, like, you end up kind of being generally a better Inquisitor, especially interrogator, by having some type of psychic ability, you know.
Okay.
Like, it's not a requirement, but it's like obviously something that will generally draw an Inquisitor to be interested in you in the first place. Now, that being said, an Inquisitor themselves are kind of self-explanatory to their name of what they do. And obviously when you have psychic powers, they can utilize that in very strong psychic capacity, you know, by just straight up psychically torturing people to get information, and or just utilizing normal forms of interrogation and torture to get people to say things. You know, really, the world's their oyster. though, obviously, you can also then just become an inquisitor normally by, you know, getting them through standard promotion, which will be done by essentially getting the approval of three other inquisitors. I don't actually know that it has to be three others. It just, my research only said or showed that it had to be three inquisitors. So it could be your own inquisitor and two others. It may have to be three others. I don't really know. Or a Lord Inquisitor, which is kind of like the rung above that, you know, like they'll be a Lord of a system or something like that, or like a sect or the Ordo itself, like the leader of the Ordo itself. They can just be like, hey, you know what? Your interrogator, your novitiate, I like their cut of their jib. Make them Inquisitor. They're ready. You know, like, cause they're the higher on the, you know, on, you know, it's like the major or colonel or anything like that, right? Like they have the capacity to give that promotion.
Right, certainly.
Otherwise, obviously, there are plenty of field promotions that happen. Your inquisitor bit the dust. They hand you their seal. They say, carry on. Or their head got blasted into bits and you grabbed their seal and are going to be the leader and you're going to take on the role. So yeah, you take on the role. You are like, they're in 6,000 bits. They got exploded by some type of orc mine or missile, or they were disintegrated by a Necron laser.
It happens.
this is mine now. So the thing about that, though, that can happen is they are always subject to repeal of their duty or their power, and that, you know, emblem, the inquisitorial emblem, kind of depending on the circumstance, an inquisitor comes to the planet, you know, and they'll know, like, this was the inquisitor who was here, what happened to them, you know, or a Lord Inquisitor will come by and it's like, oh, hey, what happened? You know, and they, if they deem that there needs to be questions or we need to determine and figure this stuff out, blah, 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 they can repeal your right to it. The title that you've kind of field taken. This is then entering into a whole political can of worms, you know,
my favorite kind.
Yeah. Obviously, like I said, because the Inquisition is generally actually very good about kind of knowing where all their inquisitors go. You know, they can determine, like, hey, but, like, the other part of that is if that happened and it was, like, 50 years ago, which isn't a whole lot of time in the grand scheme of, like, the Imperium and, like, 40K stories and everything like that, you know, because characters kind of end up living a lot of times for, like, hundreds of years. But if it's, like, 50 years or it's a whole big ass cycle of time, you know, even 100 years, and then finally somebody checks in on you again, in some regard, it's even if you file it, like if you put, hey, my inquisitor died, I've taken the role, and then like 100 years later they finally decide to send somebody over, they may try to do that, like, and be like, all right, well, I'm taking your thing for now till we figure this out. You know, somebody who's in that position might be like, no, you're not. No, no, no. You're too late. I filed this forever ago. I've taken the role. I've done so much shit in the last 100 years. No, no, no. You're not doing it. So, like, there's dependencies, right? And that's where I mean, like, it can become a political mess. But one way or another, those are the two ways that you kind of end up becoming an inquisitor. But there are three main ordos of becoming an inquisitor. And the first one we'll talk about is the Ordo Xenos. This is probably the ordo that has the most, like, well, technically I would say two of the ordos have pretty self-serving names. Ordo Xenos, definitely one of them, where you can kind of tell they are focusing on Xenos. What? Crazy. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. But obviously, they are focusing on, like, what alien threats are coming. Maybe what are the conspiracies that people have with Xenos that threaten the Imperium, right? So, you know, their jurisdiction kind of goes out to any members of the Imperium that deal with Xenos. And this could be, you know, trade, like, once we do to, like, deal with trading and their technology, those who seek or hide, you know, or protect hostile alien species, but, like, technically any Xenos is an alien, could be considered hostile to the Imperium. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it depends on the level of fanaticism the Inquisitor has. As
yeah.
Throughout all of the Inquisitors, you will find those who are Puritan and those who are radical. And radical are going to be the ones who are actually a little bit more maybe lenient on some of the aspects of how they do what they do, right? They're going to be very much the ends justify the means. And then your radical Inquisitors are those who are, like, very much by the book. We don't stray from it. We do nothing but follow the word of the law, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, especially nowadays in current 40K, in the 42nd millennium, you know, post-Cadia, a lot of times you will find that split often comes with which side of the rift you're on. Right. If you are in Imperial Nihilus, so you're on the other side of the rift where you can't really warp travel, you can't really see the Astronomicon, you're kind of cut off from the main part of the Imperium, you're willing to bend some rules to make shit work. Whereas maybe on the inside, you're going to find more Puritans who are like, all right, look, this is the rules we have. This is why we have to do it. But there are still obviously normal trade deals. Like, for example, how will somebody deal with the Votan? Some, you know, a technical Xeno species, despite their human-like nature, that the Imperium has had trade deals with for a long time, dating back even to the Great Crusade. I believe the Great Crusade. But regardless, they have had trade deals with the Votan for a long time. Right. So somebody sees, like, a mining colony that has technology from the Votan, they, you know, a proper Ordo Xenos probably isn't going to immediately shut that down, but they'll maybe look at and be like, so what you doing? Hey, well, let's check in. Like, hey, are you doing this to the book here? Like, you got this right? You know, like, something to make sure that they're not going too friendly with these Votan, right? One thing to do trade deals with them, it's another to actually, like, commingle with them. Often then you'll also see them deal with, like, rogue traders somewhat frequently, because as we'll get to, rogue traders kind of go out into the expanse and try to expand the Imperium, and thus we'll actually see the Xenos frequently. But other than that, the funny, so they have their, like, chamber militant. So the, like, arm of whatever, you know, Imperial function that they will utilize, you know, with their segment is going to be the Death Watch. So we haven't talked about them in full yet. We will, but they, to give the lowdown base of it, are veteran space marines that have proven themselves adept at fighting Xenos and are generally some of the most honorous of their chapters, and thus are also from any which chapter across the Imperium. Oops. So the funny thing about that, though, is both the Death Watch and Inquisitors are actually sometimes seen using Xenos weaponry. These are often those who are going to be labeled as radicals rather than Puritans. But that's true for both Death Watch and Ordo Xenos Inquisitors, which is really funny because it's like you'd think that the other ones would be the ones more okay with using Xenos weaponry, but you'll often see the Inquisitors that use Xenos weaponry and Xenos tech are Ordo Xenos. Which, again, you know, who said that you can't commit a crime until somebody calls you out on it? So, yeah, it's funny. They definitely run into some realms of I am the law, and then that means I can break this law too. But however, there are two notable inquisitors of Xenos. I wanted to keep it to one, but if I didn't mention both of these, I'd probably get lambasted in the comments. The first one we'll talk about, which is probably the most well-known of Inquisitors, or one of the most well-known of Inquisitors, just because of how long he's been around in our, like, in books, which is the first one being Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn. He's super well-known for his book series, authored by Dan Abnett, which are very old. Like, the first one was in the... The run of the first three books was from 2001 to 2002. So they are old.
Okay.
But he was a Puritan inquisitor turned radical. So kind of just over the length of his career, kind of ran into a shift of mentality with how, you know, he dealt with things. He's had points where he's been, you know, labeled as, you know, a renegade and or even like supposed heretic. However, he's proven himself otherwise in that stance. So despite being essentially labeled a potential, you know, a person of question twice, you know, he has proven, you know, the fact that he is in fact loyal and worthy of being an inquisitor still. So he is, I believe, still around. But just, he had a book last in 2018, so it was a bit ago, but still, very well known, very well known, and as generally kind of, especially with old head 40K fans, will always, kind of often gets a very soft spot. But one of the more kind of recent character additions to Ordo Xenos is Lord Inquisitor Kyria Draxus.
Kyria Draxus.
She, like Eisenhorn, she has been given the titles often of radical, maybe even heretical in some instances. For her specifically because of her use of Xenos tech. Specifically, she has a Eldar Shuriken launcher. And her armor uses multiple Xenos like platings within it. But she, like I said, within this, she's had somewhat soft, you know, kind of friendly relations with the Eldar. But not as many people nowadays, like, it's not a death sentence like it used to be. Especially because of Gilliman, you know, Gilliman has like a right hand man that is as an Eldar, like he is, because it's Eldrad Ulthron's right hand man, and he hangs out with Gilliman all the time, like everywhere he goes. So, you know, it's one of those things. Like the things with the Eldar right now in the Imperium are weird. Doesn't mean they never fight. Because different craft worlds are completely different rules and beings, right? Like, just because you're friendly with one Eldar Farseer doesn't mean you're friendly with the whole race, you know?
Sure.
So there's definite realms of that stuff. But she generally has had good relations with a number of Eldar, especially because her main focus as of late has been dealing with Necrons. And the Eldar, who thus also do not like the Necrons, they find, you know, a kinship in that by being able to fight with each other to defeat the Necrons. You know, given that the Eldar have had a long beef with the Necrons sent back when they were the Necron tier. So that's kind of a whole thing. The Eldar also were partly what trained her, because she is also a psyker. So they helped her hone a number of her psychic abilities. There's been a good tit for tat with her and the Eldar. But next up is the Ordo Malleus. So they're the one by their name you maybe would question, what are they? But they are the ones
who are malleable.
Right. They are the ones who are focused on fighting the forces of chaos. So these are going to be filled with some of the strongest minded inquisitors, maybe the least radical of inquisitors as well. They, you know, will hold very little leniency or hesitation against chaos and will often look at it as, you know, the surefire way to get yourself killed is to find leniency of some kind. You know, again, that doesn't mean there's not radical Ordo Malleus inquisitors, right? There are those who would feel that you should be able to utilize the power of the enemy against them, right? So not specifically falling or nothing in forms of chaos worship, but like their logic is like, we use warp travel, right? We have to dig through the warp. We need to utilize psychers to go through the warp. What is different than to maybe have a sanctioned psyker work with us to fight chaos? There's maybe a second weird thing, which we'll talk about in a second, that maybe some of them use that they shouldn't, but that's a different question. But yeah, so they tend to be the most secretive when it comes to what their work is, because one way or another, the eyes of chaos are everywhere. And especially if you are a psychic inquisitor, then you're really potentially asking for, you know, some, you know, you, them knowing what you're up to, because, you know, anytime you use anything psychic, you're reaching into the warp and they're going to see you. So, you know, they will often kind of keep their real objectives close to the chest, you know, as, you know, somebody unwittingly, right, even if, or witting or unwitting, could find themselves leaking your plans and you don't realize it, or they don't realize it maybe even, right? Like, so it's something that, like, when you are part of the Ordo Malleus, you know, you have to keep it close to the chest. So their chamber militant are the Grey Knights, which luckily we have discussed.
Hey, Grey Knights.
Yeah. So the Grey Knights, which if you want to know more about the Grey Knights, we have a whole episode on them, so go check that out. But we have obviously discussed in the past that they have utilized them for both good and somewhat of abusive extent. So yes. Your discussion in said episode about the Months of Shame. Mm-hmm. But they are the ones, so like Ordo Malleus will be the ones, though, who will command and maybe sometimes dictate where the Grey Knights go, call up. They're the ones who have somewhat free reign to call upon the aid of the Grey Knights. Grey Knights obviously still have their own autonomy, but they will actually listen to Inquisitors of Ordo Malleus, right? Maybe even just like a normal Space Marine, honestly, just tried calling them over, they might be like, it doesn't seem that bad. You can handle it. You know, something. But, like, if an Ordo Malleus is like, you need to get over here, they'll probably be more like, all right, let's go check this shit out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sure. Because they, and it's some of that comes to the realm, right, at this point in M42, especially, of, like, someone coming to a realm after especially the Month of Shame of being like, all right, look, we got to know that this is real shit. So it's a bit of knowledge and, you know, coinciding kind of trust in that aspect now. However, a notable inquisitor of the Ordo Malleus is Torquemada Cotiaz, who I've made reference to a couple times in some episodes, especially hobby related episodes. But he came to power notably by calling out the heresy of the inquisitor that founded and saved him. The one that essentially led to him becoming an inquisitor himself. He called out that inquisitor because he essentially felt that he was utilizing, he essentially called him out for being a radical, right? He felt that he was utilizing the powers of chaos too much and was being done in a way that makes him a heretic. And one of those was utilizing something called a demon host, which essentially is getting a normal human psyker and getting them attached to a demon. So there's some control that you have over it as the leader and the one who summoned it, but only so much. It's a very dangerous thing to have, right? And a demon host can become very uncontrollable very easily. And while technically Eisenhorn in his time has maybe utilized one or two, I believe, if I remember some lore correctly, it's not looked well upon by especially any inquisitors of Ordo Malleus. And thus, that being called out by Kotiaz was a big no-go. And thus, that inquisitor was not only banished from being an inquisitor, but then executed by Kotiaz himself. So he is very like, and he's, because he's very close to like, especially like being against chaos and going through the word of the law with the Imperium, because the reason he had to be saved in the first place was his world and family, you know, they were part of where he grew up and was all a part of a Imperial, essentially an Imperial church or like monastery. And you know, they were essentially kind of what clearly were at one point chaos cultists or like questionable people. And they came in supposedly seeking repentance. Right. Mm. And he was like, yeah, we'll come in. We'll bring you the light of the Emperor. And of course they betrayed everybody and tried to destroy and turn as many people to chaos as possible. And he lived because of his devotion to the Imperium. And the Emperor of Mankind. But thus he has very much, he's very radical. He's not a radical. He's a Puritan because of that. Right. Like, cause he looks at it sure. as just,
yeah.
there can be no question. If somebody once turns once to chaos, then they cannot be returned.
You give an inch, they'll take a mile.
Exactly. So he is known also then as the head of the Formosa sector. And okay. he is known well for his hammer and his dual-headed eagle familiar. And also sick. Known for his ugly-ass new model.
Oh, what? What?
Yeah, it's not.
Oh, yeah, we talked about this eagle previously.
Yeah, the eagle part's cool. His model's not.
No. Him?
Kotiaz, not. Especially, man, yeah, he went from
yeah,
this.
Yeah, this is that,
you know,
guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Like, he goes from this to this. Like, what a... What a letdown, yeah, you know?
What a downgrade.
Oh, yeah. Supreme downgrade. Because, I mean, like, I don't know how old he's supposed to look, but, like, come on. This has aura. The other doesn't.
Yeah.
The other one says, Mom said it's my turn for the Xbox.
It's screaming, like, Buzz Lightyear to me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It just, this one has so much more radiation to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The stern look. I mean, yeah, it was like an old model, but, you know, at least it like kind of held up. So, yeah, it was a huge, huge letdown for fans of Kotiaz. Mm. And just 40K in general. however, then our final Ordo is Ordo Hereticus. This was founded later than the other two major ordos, and this is the secondary result of the Age of Apostasy and the rule of Goge Van Dyer, you know. Mm. And thus, they focus primarily on combating such internal threats as treason, mutation, heresy, and witches. This clearly has some overlap with that of Ordo Malleus, especially when it comes to witches and mutation, given that often both of those aspects involve chaos. But they don't have to involve chaos. They can just be, you are refusing to pay your taxes. Pay your taxes or die. they're the like the IRS wishes that they could be the Ordo Hereticus. You know, IRS gets mad at you, they audit you. Granted, it's a nightmare, but in a different way.
Yeah.
Ordo Hereticus just shows up and it's as if the IRS showed up and just shot you in the face without asking questions. But thus, as is somewhat clear. They will utilize the Sisters of Battle as their chamber militant. Again, coincides with their similar creation following the Age of Apostasy. You know, the Ordo Malleus being formed, thus also saw the great benefit they could have to having the Sisters of Battle. So they created the Ordo Passive to, mm-hmm. but like kind of allowed the loophole to let the Sisters of Battle to exist. You know, obviously their relationship is very similar to how the Grey Knights are with the Ordo Malleus. You know, the sisters themselves are allowed to wage their campaigns with two of the ecclesiarchy, you know, because they are technically run by the ecclesiarchy itself. But the Ordo, you know, Ordo Hereticus comes a calling, they're going to answer. And they'll do so happily because they believe the Inquisition to be the word of the Emperor and thus will not question. Though, I will note in the Rose at War book, which is a collection of many books and novellas, there is a really cool story about a squad of sisters of the Order of Bloody Rose kind of having to deal with maybe an Inquisitor that might be falling from grace, you know? An Inquisitor that raises question marks. And how do you, as somebody in the Sisters of Battle and in the position of the Sisters of Battle, deal with that? It's a great story. The Rose at War, though, is also just a great book. So very, very long because it has many books in it, but it's kind of like an omnibus, but not, it doesn't contain full novels.
Gotcha.
It's a whole, yeah, you know. But their most well-known Inquisitor, and possibly one of the most well-known Inquisitors of recency, is Katarina Greyfax. She came into the setting kind of around the war, you know, the War of Cadia, which in our real world took like over a decade to go through. She came into the setting after being released from a Tesseract vault of Trazen the Infinite. So we don't really know much about when she got put into the Pokeball or how old she is prior to that, because she has this kind of like soft amnesia a bit. It's like a weird, they don't get too deep into like her origins, right? At least nothing that I saw. But upon coming into the, essentially releasing into the Pokeball and getting into the War of Cadia, she was a little thrown off because clearly she was put into this Pokeball, well, maybe just before the 41st millennium, but definitely like well before a number of things shifted, right? And got maybe a little radical, you know? Mm-hmm. So she, you know, was suddenly seeing that there was a bunch of sanctioned psychers. There was suddenly the space wolves using a mutants with the wolf in. You know, she's like, what the hell is going on? And now there's a bunch of these, you know, dorks in the Imperial Guard, and they're worshiping this seeming demon called Celestine. She has a very love-hate relationship with Saint Celestine. However, they get a number of adventures together within and after the fall of Cadia. And there's like a lot of her stories and books generally end up relating to like what how is Inquisitor Greyfax going to deal with her repressed emotions and potentially attractions to Saint Celestine.
Oh God. Okay.
Oh dude, like they get pushed together. Cause like the thing is like Celestine represents every form of like, because she's a Puritan, right? At heart. And everything about Celestine like rages to her, like this is wrong. But like then again, everything that she sees Celestine do is a showcase to the power of the Emperor, because she is only ever part of the word of the Emperor. She utilizes light and power that clear that would showcase itself to look like that it would be part of the Emperor's gift. Because she wasn't really around other living saints, seemingly, right? Because mm-hmm. there have been other living saints in the time of the Imperium, like post, you know, post-Emperor Golden Throne, post-heresy. But yeah, she's trying to deal with a lot of that. One of her most notable recent campaigns was obviously, was I've kind of made a mention of this in the Sisters episode, but she worked with Celestine and the custodian who actually put the original Sisters in front of the Golden Throne. And essentially leading to the removal of an ecclesiarch, one of the recent head ecclesiarchs, because he tried to remove the Ordo Passive and have like a full on military arm of the ecclesiarchy again. And while technically, like, that maybe was somewhat reason on its own to maybe bring him into question, the Inquisition wasn't necessarily ready to just like immediately deal with this.
Sure.
But she and Celestine like saved that ecclesiarch from being assassinated many times by imperial and non-imperial assassins. Even at some point, the like Black Templars try to like get him. It's a whole thing. It's a part of an audio drama. But then eventually, Celestine. And everyone else kind of decide, you know what? It's cool if he dies. He's probably kind of a traitor. Let's just let it. And so Celestine decides, you know what? You're not speaking to the word of the Emperor. I'm going to execute you. And everyone just kind of like, oh, what's over there? She's like, I'm a behead him. And he's like begging for his life. And like, the fucking like custodian and Greyfax are just like, oh man, I don't know what's going on over here though. It's definitely not happening over there.
Is that a bird flying by?
That's yeah. Oh, that's a blue-tilted swallow. Wow, that's rare around here.
Yeah, out of season, you know, out of season.
So she's otherwise like very well known for, you know, her hard-headedness, and she is always willing to wield her authority with an iron fist. Mm-hmm. She's otherwise very well known for, you know, utilizing her, you know, her witch hunter cap.
And, her pilgrim hat.
Yeah, and her a condemner bolt gun, which is like a, you know, essentially kind of like a more a bolt pistol, but like almost has this like crossbow on the top of it. This is one of those weapons where it's like, no idea when it comes to practicality, but it looks cool. But it looks cool. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's about it for the main thing with the three Ordos is, you know, you've got your Xenos, Malleus, and Hereticus.
Cool.
On the tabletop, the Inquisition is part of the Imperial Agents. And they're a bit of a weird bag right now. But part of that comes from, you know, they are a new faction in technicality. So, because for much of the game's history, they've always kind of had a non-codex. So, like, rules that kind of float between a bunch of the Imperial armies, you know? So you could, like, put Inquisitors into a number of other Imperial-based armies and other agents of the Imperium, you know, like, such as, you know, like, assassins and things like the Adeptus Arbides, which we'll talk about later. Yes, they've been a weird floating. So now that they finally have a codex, they're going through some teething issues, right? Some growing pains. So that being said, you know, now that they have a rule set, there's a bit of a question, like, right? Like, what is it that maybe is good to gauge with collecting them, right? And there's a couple things that are good for that, right? And the first is that obviously the rules will change. So they could end up with some really cool detachments, army rules, and whatnot in editions down the line. And the reminder, they change editions like once every 3 to 4 years. So you don't have to wait that long. The other is, honestly, the benefit that you get is you kind of can start building into a second army by starting this, or vice versa, right? Start an army. Like, if you wanted to start with Grey Knights, Death Watch, or Sisters, you can very easily start pushing into building an Imperial Agents army, because you're getting a bunch of the points that you can put into an Imperial Agent army. Now you just add a bunch of characters that are Inquisitors, right? Or maybe some extra things like those Arbetes, or maybe a Rogue Trader squad, right? You can throw some extra things in there. But like, you essentially then, if you've got, like for me, I have Sisters, I essentially have half the army already. I'm already on my way to having an Imperial Agents army.
Yeah.
So it's nice, right? It's like a cheap way to get two armies. Whichever way you cut it, right? So that's what's nice. You know, that's a nice thing about them. And again, you can then do that, wait for later, and they'll maybe get, maybe then they'll get some good rules later on. So, you know, it's not something to definitely look negatively on. They have cool looking models out there, you know. Like outside of KOTS, but you can even use like Imperial Navy breachers with them. You can technically, I think, use things with or from, I don't remember if Black Templars have a way in with the Ordo Hereticus. Two, not 100% sure on that one. But you get a lot of like souping from other armies, you know, just bringing them in.
Yeah.
And that's what's nice. But any main questions about, the Inquisition?
No, they're remarkably pretty straightforward, I feel like.
To start, obviously.
To start, sure.
Yeah, because the thing about the Inquisition that's really important is the characters, right? Mm-hmm. I could have listed so many freaking characters for each Ordo, right? And, like, look, in the comments, put some Inquisitors. Put some of your favorite Inquisitors that I didn't talk
Fill
about.
Fill them up.
Name talk them out. Like, look, because, like, that's what the Inquisition is so interesting, is they have characters.
There's so many key figures that have like really unique stories and personalities.
And they're not so limited by like the hierarchy of as many things. So you kind of get this realm where you can kind of let them freely explore the galaxy and like deal with things in the Imperium, but then also get some character bias and allow them to live maybe some things that they may otherwise wouldn't, you know. But, like, you know, that's the nice part, right? You're able to kind of fluctuate this thing. So that's the maybe, like, we're really, like, this is an overview, right? So we're really scratching the surface when it comes to, like, characters of the Inquisition. But, yeah, when you think of just at least the three Ordos, it's a relatively simple aspect. They have all power. They're pretty much just limited by each other and maybe their higher ups of Lord Inquisitors. But like, they're otherwise just trying to keep the way things are going here in the Imperium. But yeah, no, I mean, anything extra that you have wonders about?
Nope. My mind is clear. I have no thoughts about chaos or anything of that sort. definitely don't inquire further into that. I'm good. Good to go.
You have to remember the Inquisition's essentially tagline, which is Innocentia Nihil Probat. Innocence proves nothing.
Great.
Silence is palpable. Yeah,
perfect.
The innocence proves nothing people are the ones who have the most power in the Imperium. Hence why I mentioned, does absolute power corrupt? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Only when you get caught though. But yeah. They are also the ones who are fighting said corruption. So it's not to be said that they don't do anything or that they are, you know, truly all evil. They're just kind of dicks about it sometimes, as is many things in 40K, though. So, can you truly blame them?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we can. But that can still make them interesting characters in some scenarios.
Sure.
I.e., you get into Eisenhorn stuff. At least according to some people. Other people do think they're old and boring. That's, you know, that's a realm of opinions we don't need to get into this episode. But that'll do it for the Inquisition. At least our basic covering of it.
All right.
Next week, we're gonna hit into some other hobby topic again. So definitely, you know, tune in for that. But other than that, thank you so much for watching or listening. And we'll see you next week.
Goodbye, goodbye.